7:02 on a Monday. Happy Monday, everybody. Halford Bruff, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Bruff of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. We are also brought to you by North Star Metal Recycling. North Star! Vancouver's premier metal recycler pays the highest prices on scrap metal. North Star Metal Recycling, they recycle, you get paid. Visit them at 1170 Powell Street in Vancouver. I got to mention a couple other things as well. First hour, forgot to do so. All of our Canucks preseason coverage was brought to you by Black & Lee. Suiting up has never been easier with suits and tuxedos in a modern, wide range of colors, styles, and fits. Visit them online at blackandlee.com. Finally, it's time now for our Monday morning quarterback, brought to you by the Clayton Public House. He is our NFL insider from Football Outsiders. He is Mike Tannier here on the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
15 hours of NFL football, followed by 5 hours of sleep, followed by more football. I am living the dream.
So you got up to watch the London game, did you? I did not. It's 6 o'clock our time. I was like, I do not need to see the Saints or the Vikings that badly. But I'm assuming you were there for the full poll yesterday.
For the full poll. And you made the wise life decision to skip that early game because things got much better after that one. But yet we get to do it all again next week with the Giants in the morning, the 3-1 Giants in the morning.
So I know you mentioned 15 hours of football. That means you stayed till the bitter end, and that, of course, was the primetime game. Let's start with Sunday Night Football, the Chiefs and the Bucks. And there are certain instances seemingly in every NFL season that involves Patrick Mahomes where he goes out and has a game and you say, oh, that's right, I remember that. That's why he's appointment viewing. And we got one of those last night in a big win and some Super Bowl revenge for the Chiefs over the Bucks.
Yeah, it looks like a Pixar movie sometimes. He goes out there and he does these, like, I'd never seen anything like that before with turnaround jump shot touchdowns and other things like that. And it was really mixed in this week, not just with that, but with a normal conventional running game by the Chiefs. Like, they were able to just sort of run the ball for 5 yards a clip. And also, Mahomes delivered his short passes and really didn't make any of the goofy Chiefs mistakes that we're famous for until late in the game. So, dominating game on offense. Pretty strong game on defense until late, again, where, you know, Brady was going to do his Brady things, especially in the second half. But a convincing win that reminds us that, yeah, the Bills are great. The Chiefs are still there. The Chiefs have not gone away just because Tyreek Hill's not there anymore.
It was a remarkable performance because that's a Tampa Bay defense which had been lights out through the first 3 weeks of the season. You put up 41 points on that defense. I think they only punted once in the entire game, and they had about 38 minutes of possession time. So it was one of those games that kind of solidified that at the end of the year, no matter what, you know, weapons they might have lost or what wrinkles they might have, the Chiefs are going to probably be there at the very end in the AFC. I want to talk about the other team that might be there with them, and that was the Buffalo Bills, a 23-20 win over the Ravens. Now, solve the debate for us here. We're having it with a few listeners who are pushing back. Did John Harbaugh make the right call for the Ravens at the end there, going for the touchdown instead of kicking the field goal?
I did not like it. The Football Outsiders analytics like it, but like to a tiny, tiny degree. Like, the percentage points are about 1% off, 2% off. It's just a matter of, I understand the reasoning, and John Harbaugh went through it in detail, saying, well, you know what, if we give them the ball back, then there's a very high probability that they march down the field, kick a field goal, or get a touchdown. And that's all true, but then he says, you know what, and if we don't make it, but it's not an interception, well, they're at the 2-yard line and we trust our defense. And it's like, okay, well, which is it? Do you trust your defense or do you not trust your defense? Is the difference between the 2-yard line, a 20-yard line, 25-yard line, significant, but is it really that significant along the way? So, you know what? The way that game was going, the fact that it was rainy, the fact that they were down to their third string left tackle for the Baltimore Ravens, a lot of factors go into the idea that if you're going to try to run a pass play, it could be wind up foobar. And we say this every time the Ravens do this in the fourth quarter. You have Justin Tucker. You have to just kick the field goal is automatic. The touchback is automatic, and trust your defense a little bit. That's what I would have done. Then again, hindsight's 20/20.
We're speaking to Mike Tannier, our NFL insider from Football Outsiders here on the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. The walkthrough, one of the best Monday morning pieces of all NFL stuff, is up now at Football Outsiders. You can read it. I know that you were talking about, and you wrote extensively, about the Denver Broncos and the notion of letting Russ cook. We mentioned it in our segment that the first segment, the numbers were okay.
Can I ask the question here, Mike?
Yeah.
I hate to. Is how much better is Geno Smith than Russell Wilson? Just like is he like 10% better, 30%, 40%? I mean, we all know he's better, but the question really has become how much better Geno Smith is than Russell Wilson.
Well, what's his completion right now? 77.9? He's 77.9%.
It's ridiculous. But okay, so I want we'll put the Seahawks on the back burner here for a sec. With the what did you see from that Broncos offense and Russell Wilson yesterday? Because we pointed out it was Russ's best game with the Broncos so far, but it also came in a game in which the defense got gouged for 32 points, and the Broncos might have lost Javonte Williams for an extended period of time. So not good developments, even though Wilson had his best game statistically.
Not good developments, an offense that moved in fits and starts, which I'm guessing Seahawks fans are very familiar with, an offense that looked like it could do magic midway late in the fourth quarter, but couldn't do a lot like in the third quarter and the second quarter. Again, this is familiar territory for Seattle Seahawks fans. And I can't make hide nor hair of the problem with the Broncos because the problem keeps shifting. You mentioned that the defense got gassed. The defense looked like it got gassed in the fourth quarter because of all the three and outs in the third quarter. So you put it all together, and the bottom line is this is not what the Broncos were hoping for. The Broncos didn't want to hear about how their defense, which was playing well, buckled at the end, because that's what happened to the Broncos in 2021, 2020, 2019, 2018, 2017. They don't want to hear about how they had to sort of swap out a win on like punts and things, because that's what they used to do. It's supposed to be better right now for the Broncos, and it's not.
I want to turn our attention now to my lock of the week from last week. It was the Jacksonville Jaguars. I like them at +6.5 going to take on a Philly team where, yes, they were off to a 3-0 start, but I thought there might have been some value there. It started great. Jacksonville was up 14-0. I was like, this is perfect. This is going to be great. And then Trevor Lawrence, this is a statistic for everybody, the first quarterback this century to lose four fumbles in a single game, and then it ends up being Philly 29. Jack, I can hear you groaning in the background there. Jacksonville 21, Philadelphia 29. What the heck happened here, Mike?
Little course correction for Trevor Lawrence, still a second-year quarterback. I don't know how many bad weather games he has in his resume up until now, how many really good defenses he's faced in this 2022 reality where he's considered a top 10 quarterback. The reality sets in for him, okay? He's having a hard time holding onto the ball on a fourth down scramble where he kind of kicks it out of his own foot. He botches a snap. He gets strip sacked. It's a little different facing a really elite pass rush, playing from behind, which the Jaguars were for much of the second half, and playing in the rain, which, again, is something he's not used to. I still think Trevor Lawrence is a heck of a quarterback, but this is an example of a team. They come out, they win a couple games, they get a couple blowouts, they're the upstarts. They're the darlings. We talk about them. And there's a lot of situations that they haven't faced yet or that they haven't proven they can handle yet. And there were a lot of situations yesterday the Jaguars realized, oh, yeah, we're not ready to face that quite yet. And the Eagles answered the call.
Another question for you. Did you have any idea who Bailey Zappi was prior to yesterday?
Yeah.
Yes. So for those that don't know, he, of course, was the third-string quarterback coming into this year for the New England Patriots. And then thanks to injuries to Mac Jones and Brian Hoyer, Bailey Zappi from Western Kentucky was out there yesterday and doing not a bad job, I might add, going toe-to-toe with Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers before the Packers prevailed in overtime. But very interesting development, and maybe it kind of underscores that, you know, if you game plan correctly, you can get all the way down in your depth chart to the Bailey Zappies of the world and still be competitive.
If you can run the ball very hard, which the Patriots can do, if you can force turnovers, which the Patriots can do. So they did all of those things. I'm going to tell you, my lock of the week was the Patriots and the points. I got 9.5 with Brian Hoyer out there. I was sitting pretty by overtime with a win there, because it doesn't matter if it's Brian Hoyer or Bailey Zappi, these guys can barely play. You know, Brian Hoyer can barely throw the ball, and Zappi knows about 10 plays, and that's what it boils down to. You still get that, and you can still give a team a run for the money if you're playing well. That said, Patriots have a big question moving forward, because Mac Jones has a high ankle sprain. They're pretending it's not a high ankle sprain. They're pretending he can just come back next week, or he could have played Sunday or whatever. We don't know where this pretense is going to land, whether they're going to throw Mac Jones out there on crutches, or Bailey Zappi out there knowing 11 plays instead of 10, or Brian Hoyer, let's hope no one's messing around with concussion protocols these days, and we don't see him for a while. And this is a bad turn of events for a New England Patriots team that is really doing their best to get by on running and defense, but they're 1-3 right now. They're not fooling anybody. They do have the Lions. That's probably a winnable game. They've got some winnable games coming up, but they've got to get things figured out.
As soon as Dak Prescott is healthy, does he necessarily get the start for the Cowboys?
I can't believe in my heart of hearts, in my mind, that this is a serious conversation. And yet we're having it. I was on a previous radio show. They're having it. I know this is in the zeitgeist right now.
Yeah.
It is Looney Tunes. You know, Cooper Rush played pretty well in the first game. The Cowboys are a pass rush with a team attached. They get the sacks. They get the turnovers. They give the ball to Cooper Rush. He throws it downfield, hopes to get a pass interference penalty. If he does, you get a touchdown. If not, you get a field goal. That's what they're doing right now. This is not a sustainable path to success in the NFL. Once they get Dak Prescott back, and it might be this coming Sunday, then you've got Gallup back. You've got CeeDee Lamb playing a little better than he was at the start of the season. You're figuring things out in the offensive line. Jason Peters is now a guard, and that's good for them. You can make a run with Dak Prescott. If you play goofy games with a quarterback controversy, you're saying, oh, we're just going to be 500 and try to win games with Micah Parsons and Tank Lawrence. That's not sustainable. Opponents are starting to figure it out. It's not the way the Cowboys are going to go.
Speaking of quarterback controversies, apparently we have one that's brewing right now in Indianapolis. I don't know if you've seen the remarks this morning, but second string running back Nyheim Hines, who might be the starter now that Jonathan Taylor's hurt, he came out this morning and he said, this isn't an excuse, but every year we have a new quarterback. Each year we're restarting and we have to turn the page. Those are pretty strong words from a guy who's, again, has watched this play out, because it went from Phillip Rivers to Carson Wentz to Matt Ryan. And, you know, I think there's a sense that the Colts have enough talent at other parts of the game, including at running back, where they should be good, but they keep shooting themselves in the foot by going to the same playbook with the let's bring in a new recycled quarterback. And now, given how bad their start to the season has been, feels like it might be boiling over a bit in Indianapolis.
Yeah, and I was saying that from the moment they moved on from Carson Wentz and brought in Matt Ryan, instead of saying, hey, you know what? It is rebuilding time. It's rebuilding time. Let's go into the draft or whatever. And now you see the players are saying it. And this was a good example. Matt Ryan comes in. Yeah, he's a better decision maker, a better leader than Carson Wentz. I'm not going to say who in the world is a better decision maker and leader than Carson Wentz. I don't want to go down that path. But Ryan comes in. He is immobile. He can get rushed right up the middle. He doesn't have as quick a trigger as he used to. Opponents have the book on him. And the Colts can't get anything going in the first quarter, can't get anything going in the first half. They're down 24-0. Teams drop back in the zone. Yeah, Ryan starts picking them apart and plays catch-up. It's not a good path to success, and it doesn't just hurt the Colts this year. It's going to hurt them next year because the quarterback of the future is not on the roster yet, and they're going to have to dive into the draft for it. Bad decision-making all around, and it's noteworthy, like you said, that guys like Nyheim Hines on that offense are starting to notice.
Hey, Mike, do you have any idea how this investigation into Tua Tagovailoa's concussion status, or whether it was a concussion, whether it was a back injury or whatever. I mean, there's so much noise out there. How do you think this is going to play out?
I don't mean to be laughing, but it's sort of like, you know, cackling with the ridiculousness of this. You know, a team doctor was let go. That's a positive step. If they diagnosed a back injury back then and every piece of paperwork says back injury, you can't retcon it and call it a concussion, even though I think all of us know it's a concussion. Like, the world's stuck with that. So the main positive takeaway is the NFLPA and the NFL, they got together, they released a new statement, and they kind of took the word concussion and head injury out of it and said, hey, if there's instability, he can't come back to the field until XYZ happens. So you can't have a guy get an obvious concussion and say, it was ring around the collar or something like that and bring him back in. The instability itself, the obvious sign itself that something concussion-like happened, gets them off the field. And, I can't relitigate the Dolphins and go back and say, well, here's the 20 things you did wrong. We can move forward and say, if we make decisions like that, they don't bring Tua back onto the field the previous Sunday, and it may force them to trigger a better prognosis and diagnosis that keeps them out of the next game as well. And that's the best we can make of it right now.
Before we let you go, Monday Night Football tonight, 49ers and Rams. If the 1-2 49ers beat the 2-1 Rams, that means that every team in the NFC West will be at an even 2-2. What are you looking at tonight when San Fran takes on LA?
very little. You know, I'm not excited about this game at all. I'm sorry. I think the Rams are going to win. You know, they're a four-man team now more than ever with Cooper Kupp, Aaron Donald, Jalen Ramsey, and Stafford doing everything. I'm not a believer in this new Garoppolo, and the reason I'm not a believer is the 49ers aren't believers, and Kyle Shanahan isn't a believer in it, and I don't think he's going to pick up where he left off the way people claim. So I think the Rams are going to get the win here and go to 3-1. But I think it's going to be an ugly game overall.
We now live in a world where you can make a very, very legitimate argument that Geno Smith is the best quarterback in the NFC West. Just how I wanted to put that out there so everyone could digest that for a moment. It is quite remarkable. Mike, thanks for doing this today, bud. Great stuff as always. We always appreciate it. Enjoy the game tonight as much as you can, and we'll do this again next Monday.
Absolutely. Take care. Enjoy your week.
You too. Thanks. That's Mike Tannier, our NFL insider from Football Outsiders here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. He, of course, is a presentation of the Clayton Public House. 15 screens, two giant projectors to watch all the football you can. Visit them online at ClaytonPub.com. Now, I know we want to get back into the Canucks stuff, and we will. We got a lot of time left here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650, but the Geno Smith thing. The one thing that I hope doesn't happen, and this is unfair to Geno Smith, who's done nothing wrong and has played terrific football through the first 4 weeks of the season. I really hope that the Seahawks don't go down the road of kind of what the Colts have done the last 3 years, where they either talk themselves into a quarterback or they kind of think, well, maybe with a couple tweaks and a couple differences, this could be. I hope that they realize this is a moment in time and a nice story for Geno, but it can't go on beyond this year.
Well, it depends. Where they finish in the standings and what quarterbacks are available to them in the draft and how they look at those players in the draft. And if they're able to get their guy, they should obviously get him.
I mean, this is a year.
But if they can't get it, you know, I Pete Carroll's probably going to just be like, all right, well, we're just going to keep going here.
Well, Pete, here's the thing. Given Pete's age and his competitive makeup and the way that he's wired.
Yeah.
He would see winning 7 or 8 or 9 games with this team as a good thing, mm-hmm. and a win for the organization. The reality is, and the one takeaway that I had from Tannier was, you're just kind of wasting time. Like with the Colts, the last 3 years, if they think that they've got a good enough team to compete, then you have to do something more at the quarterback position than what you've done.
Sure.
And if you don't have the quarterback,
go big or go home, really.
Then you got to go home. Yeah. That's exactly it. You can't piecemeal this stuff together.
My ideal scenario would be that the Seahawks are able to draft the quarterback of the future, but maybe keep Geno Smith for a year where that quarterback either learns from Geno Smith. Like the one thing you don't want to do is put a young quarterback into a position where he cannot succeed or where it's going to be very, very tough for him to succeed. Sure, you'll learn a little bit about how he can deal with adversity, but there are limits to that. Geno Smith is, he's a great bargain right now. Do you know what his salary is? $3.5 million.
Yeah, he's, I mean, it's a good.
Almost no team spends less on their quarterbacks than the Seattle Seahawks.
That's true.
But it's not, that's not the way, you don't like bargain basement your way to Super Bowls.
No,
right?
I mean,
it just
proven.
Doesn't happen,
it's
right?
It's been proven how you win.
Yeah.
I mean, it's through the quarterback.
Look, watch Patrick Mahomes. Did you see him?
That was ridiculous.
Yesterday,
absolutely
some of
ridiculous.
The things he does, it is absolutely incredible. He's still the guy that I would take over all of them, and you can have that debate. Like, I have time for the debate. I have time for, no, I'd rather Josh Allen, or I would rather, you know, Aaron Rodgers or whatever. Some people might still be like, look at Brady. I'd rather have him. That mm-hmm. guy, no one wins more than him. There are so many great quarterbacks in the NFL right now, but I don't think anyone reaches the level of Patrick Mahomes.
It was pretty the one to Edwards-Helaire where he got within like an inch of the end zone and then did the flip. And that, I mean, those are the kind of plays that differentiate good from great and then great from elite. And to be perfectly honest, if you look at the way that the game is going, you need those kind of guys there. We've got a lot more to get to on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. So a reminder, our guest list for today, Mike Tannier. All done. Great hit by Mike. If you want to go back and download the podcast, it will be available at the end of the hour. Hour one is already up. Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, download the Halford and Brough podcast. Coming up, we're going to talk about the end to one of the longest playoff droughts in sports history. The Seattle Mariners are back in the postseason for the first time in over 20 years. 2001 was the last time that the Mariners went to the postseason. Ichiro was a rookie that year, to put that into perspective.
That's a while ago.
Lou Piniella was still managing.
Yeah.
Edgar Martinez was their star player.
We still had potential.
Still had potential.
Right? Like, we were still in that point in our life where, like, maybe they'll turn themselves into something.
Could have done something.
Right? But not everyone gets to turn themselves into something, right? Not everyone gets to live the dream. I also want to hear from the listeners, and here's the question I'm throwing out here about the Vancouver Canucks. What's your concern level about the Canucks? Mike and I have both said that we're not going to freak out about the preseason, even if you do have a dud, a real dud, like you had against the Seattle Kraken over the weekend. We'll freak out if the Canucks in the regular season don't do well. Mm-hmm. But you gotta keep some freak out in reserve, you know, just in case you need it. I think the Canucks preseason has been mixed. Some people will say it's been more negative than positive. I don't know. Just for me, Pettersson is such a key to this team, and I've been saying it over and over, that the way he looks in the preseason, and of course he didn't play against the Kraken the other night, but the way he's looked is just really encouraging to me. Mm-hmm. He looks like he has his confidence back. He's got a ton of energy, you know, offensively, defensively. I just really like the way he's looked. And the issues that cropped up against Seattle were issues that I already knew they had, right? It's the defense. And I can't keep going on and on about it because it doesn't seem like anything's going to change, right? This is the defense. So if they go into the season and the defense is the main issue that keeps them from winning games, then we'll sit there and we'll just say, I told you so. If they find a way to maybe the defense isn't going to be amazing, but they make up for it in goaltending or offense or the power play, you know, like, great. Then that's good for the Canucks. But one thing I'm not expecting is for the defense to be really good. I'm just not. And I'm not talking about defending. I'm talking about moving the puck and the big picture thing, all the things that a defense – I really wish they weren't called defensemen, frankly.
Like, do you wish they were called?
Why do you want them to be called?
I honestly, like –
you've piqued my curiosity.
No. But like, we've had this discussion before, you know, like a back.
Bring back the Rover.
No, but like they, you know, like I know they call
Backman,
like, or like a, I don't know, I don't know, but like,
sounds like a Mega Man.
We need to workshop this.
But the worst is because you get these uneducated hockey fans that will text and be like, "There's a reason they're called defensemen. Their idea is to put they're so important in transitioning the puck,
move the puck, man.
out of yeah, but they do more than that. They're just backs, right?
Like, keep workshopping.
That's what they do. Well, I don't know. They're not like guards.
I don't mind Rovers.
Rover. They're not Rovers. Rovers means they play everywhere, all over the ice.
Yeah.
It's a fun name.
Behind the other net.
Jason. That's, Rover is very apropos from one guy named Laddie and one guy named A-Dog.
At any rate, we've gotten off track.
Yeah, we have. Okay, well, let's focus back.
I want to hear from the listeners. The question is, what's your concern level for the Canucks in the preseason? We're not going to judge you. If it's high, go ahead and say your concern level is high. If it's low, you know, say, I never worry about the preseason.
Professor, without knowing precisely what the danger is, would you say it's time for our viewers to crack each other's heads open and feast on the goo inside?
Yes, I would, Kent.
I'm with him. It's time to freak out. Okay, so here's what we're going to do in the next segment. We're going to talk Canucks, and we're going to dive into the Dunbar Lumber text message in basket. Are you concerned about the preseason? But coming up, we are going to talk about the longest playoff drought in baseball history coming to an end. Seattle Mariners on their way to the postseason. We are going to be joined by Curtis Rogers from Seattle Sports Talk Radio. That's all coming up next. Don't go anywhere. Halford Bruff, Sportsnet 650.
Time now for Sportsnet 650 traffic from the City News 1130 Air Patrol.
Three, two to Cal. The pitch from Acevedo.
Home run of the year. That's right. The party is going on. Congratulations to the Mariners.
7:32 on a Monday. Happy Monday, everybody. Halford Bruff, Sportsnet 650. That was the call from the Mariners breaking the longest playoff drought in baseball. They are on their way to the postseason for the first time since 2001. Halford and Bruff of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. We are also brought to you by North Star Metal Recycling. Vancouver's premier metal recycler pays the highest prices on scrap metal. North Star Metal Recycling, they recycle, you get paid. Visit them at 1170 Powell Street in Vancouver. For more on this long-awaited end of the drought and the celebration, which lasted 10 minutes on the field after that walk-off home run you heard on the call there. Joining us now, Curtis Rogers from Seattle Sports Radio here on the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. Good morning, Curtis. How are you?
Good morning, guys. Yeah, I just got home for my celebration, actually. Sun rising over here. I think might as well check on the wife and kids after celebrating all weekend.
Okay, so this is the first time we've had you on the show. I'm not actually sure how old you are, but this is always a great question to ask in relation to a 20-plus year playoff drought. Were you actually alive the last time that the Mariners made the playoffs?
I was 10 years old, so I'm 31 now. I've got a wife. I've got a baby girl. Like, my life is completely different from where it was 21 years ago. I was in the fifth grade. I actually remember listening to Mariners playoff games on the radio in class. My teacher, she let us do that, unbelievably. But that's how long ago it was, 21 years ago. I mean, seeing all the posts on social media about, like, where the world was that long ago and where it is now, I mean – you can't blame Mariners fans for just going absolutely nuts this weekend celebrating. Yeah, it was a wild card berth, but it's just the ending of this drought that has basically defined Mariners baseball over the last couple decades.
Has it been hard for you and, like, maybe your friends to be Mariners fans? Because a lot of the time, you know, when you become a fan, it might be during a playoff run or excitement. You know, eventually you look at a team and you're like, maybe it's not worth it following you.
So I went to college out of state, and a lot of people that I met where I was at school, when they would find out I was a Mariners fan, they were like, why? Like, and the drought was about half as long as what it was prior to Friday. And it's like, yeah, I was born into it. When I was a kid, it was Ken Griffey Jr. It was Alex Rodriguez. It was Randy Johnson. It was Edgar Martinez. Like, you couldn't help but fall in love with that team and follow them. And that was a big reason why so many people in the state of Washington and really in the Pacific Northwest became Mariners fans, was how great those teams were. But then the dry spell, and there were some really unwatchable years of Mariners baseball. I think about the 2010 season where they lost over 100 games, had a payroll of $100 million. But through it all, I mean, having it pay off in the way that it did on Friday night, I don't know if I'd go through it again, but it certainly made it a lot more poetic.
Is it how do you feel about the fact that the Mariners might not even host a playoff game because of the format of the wild card?
Yeah, that would be a little bit of a bummer for sure. Based off of where they are in the standings right now, the earliest they could host a playoff game would be Game 3 of the American League Division Series, which obviously there's no guarantee of that happening. There is an outside shot that they host in the first round. I know the Blue Jays have a lead on the Mariners right now that is pretty comfortable, and their magic number is 2 to clinch home field in that first round. I think Mariners fans are at a point right now, though, where they are kind of happy to be here. Obviously, you want to advance in the playoffs. You want to be able to compete for a championship. I do think this Mariners roster, if the offense can get going, if they can produce consistently, and they're going to get Julio Rodriguez back tonight, that's basically what we've been told by the Mariners, is that Julio will return to the lineup tonight, then – yeah, I think they can absolutely compete and get a home playoff game eventually. The problem is their offense has just been so hit or miss, pardon the pun there, in the second half of this season, where it's hard to bank on them consistently producing. Now, the pitching has been incredible. The starting pitching has been great. The bullpen has been great for the most part. I have no issues with that. I just think it's going to come down to the offense. The Mariners want to see home playoff baseball in October. The offense is going to have to get going.
When you don't make the playoffs and you have consistent disappointment during the regular season. It's hard to build up rivalries. I'm wondering, though, what Mariners fans think of the Blue Jays, and I'm wondering if there was a list of rivals where the Blue Jays would be, if only because a bunch of drunk, obnoxious Blue Jays fans come down to Seattle from Vancouver every summer, and maybe that's the rivalry that Mariners fans have?
I think that's very fair to say. I think the rivalry with Mariners fans is with Blue Jays fans rather than the Blue Jays themselves. I think if a series were to be played here in Seattle between the two teams, I would be very curious to see how many Blue Jays fans get in the door because of playoff ticket sales having already been sold out here. I don't know how many Blue Jays fans will be able to get their hands on tickets if that were to happen. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. I will say this, Mariners fans do not want to see the Blue Jays in that wild card round if it means having to play in Rogers Center. Hmm. Just seeing how crazy that place is, especially in October. The two moments that stand out to me are the Jose Bautista bat flip and then the Edwin Encarnacion walk-off against the Orioles. I mean, just seeing how crazy of an atmosphere Rogers Center can be in October, I think Mariners fans want no part of that. Until you absolutely have to face the Blue Jays at some point, which, look, if the Mariners are able to avoid the Blue Jays in the wild card round, the only way you could face Toronto then would be in the American League Championship Series, which would mean Toronto would have knocked off Houston along the way, which I think everybody would be all for that. Mm-hmm. No one wants to see Houston win anymore. I think avoiding Rogers Center would be the best route for the Mariners in that wild card round by any means possible, whether that means playing on the road against Cleveland or hosting the wild card round. But, yeah, in terms of rivalry, I don't think there's a rivalry at all between the players. I do know that the players do get kind of frustrated when the Blue Jays come to town and T-Mobile Park gets taken over by Blue Jays fans. I think it was Marco Gonzalez a couple of years ago had mentioned something like, you know, they come in here and they mess up our furniture. They leave mud on our front doorstep. So there was some frustration with that. But obviously this year, I mean, the Mariners swept the Blue Jays in four games down here in Seattle. So maybe the tides are turning a little bit in that way. But, yeah, if the Mariners can avoid playing any baseball in Toronto prior to the American League Championship Series, that is the route they want to take.
We're speaking to Curtis Rogers from Seattle Sports Radio here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. You know, timing really matters, and timing's important for a lot of these situations. The one at hand, like this 21-year playoff drought ending for the Mariners was great on its own. But the fact that it comes at a time where the Seahawks are kind of in a state of transition and maybe not all that exciting to watch on a weekly basis, although Sunday was great. The Sounders missed the playoffs for the first time ever in 2009. You got to go all the way back to that. The Kraken haven't exactly taken the market by storm, although they've been good in the preseason. You do the pre and post for the Mariners on the station. Has this kind of extended beyond a story that is just about Mariners fans and now is about more of the market in the city of Seattle? Has it really captured the imaginations like that?
Absolutely. You look at just how the sports landscape has been in Seattle over the last decade plus, it has been dominated by the Seahawks, and with good reason. I mean, it's the best stretch of success that we've seen from the Seahawks in their franchise's history. You see Sue Bird's retirement just a couple weeks ago after her 21-year career playing for the Seattle Storm. You mentioned the Sounders, their playoff streak ending yesterday for the first time in 13 years. You can very much feel the tides turning around here, where it does feel like the Mariners are about to grab hold of the market. They obviously have the biggest star in town right now in Julio Rodriguez. He is the most recognizable face of any Seattle athlete, which is wild to say considering he has not completed his first full season at the big league level yet. I feel like the Mariners right now have really kind of captured the imagination, which you look at their beginning of the season, there was a lot of disappointment, especially after they got off to the 29-39 start. People were like, oh, this was ripe for the taking for the Mariners. They had every possibility, or they had every chance to grab hold of Seattle sports fans, and they blew it. But then that 14-game winning streak in the middle of summer catapulted them and really kind of changed the trajectory of this franchise. I've said it before where if that 14-game winning streak hadn't happened, I don't think they trade for Luis Castillo. Right. I don't think they put themselves in that position to go out and acquire an ace of the staff like Castillo and then sign him to a 5-year extension immediately after the trade. The Mariners have put themselves on a rocket ship right now, and it's cool to know that where this franchise is, it's very much the beginning, especially with Julio, but not just him. You've got Cal Raleigh, who hit the big home run on Friday night. You've got Logan Gilbert, who went 8 solid innings against Oakland. You got George Kirby, who has been the best rookie pitcher in the American League this season. It's not just one guy who's doing it. There is a foundation being built here with this Mariners franchise that makes it look like the window is just opening.
Curtis, this was awesome, man. Thanks for doing it. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the playoffs, man. It's long overdue, and it should be a lot of fun.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. That's Curtis Rogers from Seattle Sports Radio here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
I like Curtis.
He was very good.
Yeah.
He was 10 years old when the Mariners last made the playoffs. So that is a lifetime. That's adolescence, your teenage
same
years,
as me.
Young adulthood. Yeah.
I was all same age.
Just watching a team fall short of their goals.
Well, I always talk about my Canucks fandom, and the thing that stands out for me was from the time I was born until I got to high school, they never had a winning regular season.
Yeah.
So now, they did make the Stanley Cup final in 1982, but they had a losing record during the regular season there. Mm-hmm. I was also too young to appreciate that 82 run. I was only 6 years old.
Sure.
So for me, I only became a hockey fan in the kind of the years after. And the Canucks were terrible year after year after year. And it wasn't really until, you know, Pat Quinn, Trevor Linden, and Pavel Bure all arrived that the Canucks became a respectable team. For the first, you know, when you're creating your hockey fandom, those first few years, the Canucks were terrible. Like it was the year of the Oilers and the Flames. The Battle of Alberta was at its peak then. And then in the Smythe division, it was like, all right, there was the Jets, the Kings, and the Canucks, and they all kind of battled for that those final two playoff spots. And but somehow, just because they were from Vancouver, I developed that loyalty there.
Mm-hmm. And at the very least, there were the occasional playoff appearance or appearances. To not go 2 decades without tasting it and then watching it on television.
Yeah.
Look, all these other teams are having so much fun playing fall baseball.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice that the Mariners were able to get there. Now, as we turn our attention back to the Canucks very much want to be in the postseason this year. They've made that abundantly clear. Bruce Boudreau said it would be a huge disappointment if this team didn't make the postseason. So you tend to overanalyze and maybe overreact when things don't go well. Canucks have not gotten off to a good start in the preseason, and I'll asterisk that several times. It's the start of the exhibition season. It's not even the end of the exhibition season. So Jason and I are on record saying, not concerned. We've seen enough NHL seasons play out. We've seen enough teams that look amazing in the preseason that go on to have a very regular season, and vice versa. Some teams are terrible in the preseason, and they have a great regular season.
Just to clarify, we're not concerned about the preseason in a vacuum.
Yeah.
We have concerns about the team.
But the preseason, I find it hard
so
to get
much.
I cannot get worked into a lather about the Canucks not playing terrific on Saturday night in Seattle.
So we asked the listeners, what's your concern level right now? And we got a varying degree of opinions here.
Yep.
Here's an unsigned text. I'm not freaked out, but based on the last 10 years, I don't think this team has really earned the right to not show up in the preseason. They need to show the fans that this year is going to be better and different, I imagine. And it's not a great start. I think that's fair. It hasn't been a great start. Here's another one. I'm concerned insofar, man, that's a big word for the Dunbar Lumber text line.
Yep.
Insofar as they are still running this team like Jim Benning did, which was never good. And the preseason looks and feels like more of the same. Yeah, a few techs have come in and said, like, the team isn't that different.
No.
At all. So why should we expect much different? Well, I guess the answer to that would be they look different under Bruce Boudreau.
Yeah.
Right?
That was the
optimism, and that was the message heading into this season. Yeah, we didn't make many changes. In fact, We've added players, right? Mm-hmm. Like Mikheyev, who unfortunately is hurt, but you know, Curtis Lazar, you got that right shot guy who the Canucks needed. Like all the things that they added, they needed. And then Kuzmenko is the wild card. No, they didn't trade any core players, but they did add to the group.
Yeah, I'm just not sure that any of it is translatable to what's going on currently. You're talking about, and again, you'll say Helford's just making up excuses, but the first two games against Calgary were split squad. Like, they don't matter at all. Can we agree on that?
No, they don't.
They were nothing. It was a bunch of AHL guys and a bunch of fourth and fifth string goalies. Throw those aside. So their first game is against Seattle. They come out of the gates. They look fantastic.
Yeah, they look good.
Petey looked great. Kuzmenko looked great. You know, the offense was clicking. Demko looked good through the first two periods. The third period, they throw in Seelovs. He lets in a couple of questionable goals. They lose. Okay. Who cares?
They should have won in overtime.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. They could have won it in overtime. They didn't. No one seemed too upset about it. The guy that cared the most seemed to be Ryan Donato.
Or Bruce Boudreau.
Right. So there's one. You go into Seattle on the weekend. You don't have Quinn Hughes. You don't have Elias Pettersson. You don't play well. Okay. Who cares? I will start to either be concerned or be happy when the games become of consequence and everything falls in line accordingly. If they start on this road trip and are 0-4-1 after five games, then I'll be concerned.
Would you then work up a lather?
Then I would work myself into a lather.
Okay.
Because I'd say, you know what? You had a chance to get all your ducks in a row and get everything in order in the preseason. Like, if here's the thing. If this part of the process ends up working towards a good start to the season, I care less how the results are. I could care less. They didn't look good on Saturday. There's no question about that. If you want to start picking apart the process and the way that they're going about their business as opposed to the results, maybe I'll have time for it. But, hey, you take, again, a game to me is not a game if Pettersson and Hughes are actively not playing in it and going to the Michael Bublé concert, which is apparently what Pettersson did.
Yes, he was active on Instagram posting pictures.
Oh, that's where he was?
Some people took exception to that. I thought it was great.
I think he deleted it, did he not?
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't follow that.
But he's like, I told myself this before. No more social media.
Yeah. Well, he's like tweeting. He's Instagramming, however you say it, as his team was losing badly to the Kraken. He's on Instagram. This concert's awesome.
But that's the thing. That's what people need to understand. That was his mentality, and it's not wrong.
Yeah.
The Michael Bublé concert was more entertaining to him and a lot of people than the Canucks game because they didn't have their full team.
Yeah.
And they were playing against the Kraken team that really wanted to win, and it was adorable. And Hugh Parkfield, a.k.a. Dave Haxtell, was working his tail off to make sure that they got that preseason win.
Andrew in Walnut Grove texts in, how much am I freaking out? Not one bit.
Thank you.
But here's the catch.
Ooh, there's a catch.
I don't believe our core is good enough for long playoff runs, and our D is Quinn Hughes and five bottom pair defensemen. The management has done zero of the things they talked about when they got here. No new cap space or even drafting a defenseman. Canucks are mired in mediocrity, so to freak out over a meh team at best isn't worth the energy.
Andrew, meme says, he had me in the first half there, not going to lie.
Well, I
thought
the
it was going in a different direction, but he took it in an entirely different direction.
Let's pretend they make the playoffs. This Canucks D, does it have a prayer? I mean,
yes, it has a prayer.
It has a prayer. This Canucks D in the playoffs.
Yes. In the playoffs.
In the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean,
in the playoffs
to win the Stanley Cup or to win around?
Let's say win around.
Yeah, like they could. It's not good. It's far from the worst in the NHL, but for teams that are with playoff aspirations, they're on the low end. They might be the lowest of the ends, right? There's got to be a better way to say that. But if you've got Quinn Hughes, you got a great starting point, right?
Yeah.
I think it's very clear, and this, again, is way before the preseason, that they wanted to make moves and they wanted to do things differently and they weren't able to. So it just kind of became one of those, all right, let's get at it and let's see if Pullman can be a top four guy. And maybe we'll play around with some pairings and maybe we'll move Hughes to the right side. Maybe that'll fix our problems. Everyone's cognizant of it. There's nothing new to this, but as constructed, they can get to the postseason with that blue line. But it's going to, one, have to stay healthy. That's a big part of it. And two, they can't go through extended stretches where everyone looks like the puck is a foreign object because there's going to be so much emphasis on how they move the puck this year. Rutherford kind of threw it right in front of the bus when he had his remarks. Everyone knows that that's what Boudreau is going to have to probably coach up, for lack of a better term, the most. And then at a certain point, if it goes badly or pear-shaped, there's going to be this argument of, is it the coach's responsibility for not coaxing more out of the group because that's his job? Or is it management group's fault for not giving them the right tools to succeed?
Okay, I'm going to read two texts here, one unsigned.
Okay.
I'm concerned because a slow start could derail the season again, just like last year. In this next one, Jeff on the island, related to this one, do you think a Canucks losing record after 10 games would unleash Trader Jim? Well, I mean, I'm sure he'd love to be unleashed. The problem is that there just haven't been any good deals out there. Yeah, maybe he would be more willing to, I'm not saying accept a bad deal, but make a move for the sake of making a move if the Canucks do have a slow start.
Yeah.
Tanner Pearson,
you're gone. That would be the move.
We've talked about this on the show, and I was talking about this with my friends over the weekend. And we were kind of like, you know, gallows humor Canucks fans. Like, imagine if they're like 0-10 to start the season.
I don't want
to
do that.
And I'm kind of like, you know what? We've done that. We're not 0-10 necessarily, but last year was so bad to start.
Pretty close.
I'm done on that. I don't have the I don't have the anger. My anger tank is empty right now. Mm. Like, I can't do it. I couldn't muster. I mean, maybe I could. If I was a real warrior, I could muster the frustration.
His rage tank.
To a slow start.
I think you could.
Where did he find that rage?
I believe in you.
Yeah.
It was an impressive performance. No, he found that rage.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm so done.
I know.
I'm tired. So done criticizing the team and going like, oh, the defense needs to improve.
It's apathy.
Yeah. And that is a real, like, that's the risk the Canucks are at right now. Canucks fans are just going to be like, I'm not even mad.
As it relates to the text, I suppose that, you know, there might be a silver lining in that Rutherford hasn't played that card yet. He's been extremely patient by Rutherford standards. And a reminder, he is the president of hockey ops. There is a general manager, apparently, that does all this stuff in Patrick Alvin. But I think there's a couple interesting angles to that conversation. One, of course, is he hasn't played that card yet, and you know he has in the past. I say Tanner Pearson because that was the guy, and he's like, Pearson, you're gone. We got to shake up the room. And they traded him for Eric Goodbranson. The other part of this, unfortunately for Trader Jim, is he's come aboard in a flat cap world, right? He's come aboard where the team doesn't have a lot of flexibility under the ceiling, and that's, I think, hamstrung the things he wants to do as much as anything.
But they will next offseason.
Right, but I'm saying if you're 10 games into the season, you need to shake it up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as easy as it's been for him in the past.
No.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like Pittsburgh wasn't dealing with financial stresses as of their own, but he always found a way to make a deal. I think in this situation, with the contracts he inherited and the lack of space he has under the cap, I don't think it's as easy. I think he's wanted. He's wanted to make moves.
Yeah, they've said. Well, they. You know why? Because they've said so.
Exactly. So I think that there's a few different things at play here. Put it this way: if they get off to a really bad start and he's forced into making a move because that's what Jim Rutherford does, then you know things are really dire, and you know that there's a lot of pressure. Because it'll be very hard to try and make something happen, but you know that he's got that itchy trigger finger. Like, he wants to shoot his shot here. Mm-hmm. And if he gets an opportunity with maybe the season on the line or the season hanging in the balance, maybe that text will be accurate. I don't know. Okay,
let's just hope we don't go down that road, though.
I just like a nice start.
How about 7-3? 7-3 out of the gates. Let's do that.
Public service address. Someone asked about the Google podcast. What's going on
there? Yeah, we've been having tech issues with that for a while. Website we've launched, so I just always direct people to use Apple Podcasts. If you have an iPhone, it's super easy to use, or if you have an Android, use Spotify. Both are really simple.
Okay, so hour two is in the books now, so that podcast will be up shortly and available for download. Hour three is up and on the horizon. Ian McIntyre from Sportsnet is going to join us to talk Canucks, and as promised, the final half hour of the final hour will be all humanoid what we learns. Your chance to be on the radio. What did you learn over the last 72 hours in sports? Let us know. Text to the Dunbar Lumber text line. That's 650-650. Hashtag it WWL. What did you learn over the last 24 hours in sports? Let us know. Get on the radio. That's all coming up next. But iMac on the other side. It's the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650.